Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Next week in the southern Philippines, prosecutors will try to take another small step forward in the quest to put suspects in a Maguindanao massacre on trial. 58 people were killed along a remote stretch of highway in Maguindanao, one of the country's poorest provinces. They included 32 journalists and media workers, and it happened close to 4 years ago. The defendants were loyalists of the dynastic Ampatuan clan that ruled the province for 20 years. The target of the attack was a rival politician, and it's regarded as the worst single-day election-related violence in Philippine history. Our guests today are from two media centers in the Philippines that have been pressing for justice in the Maguindanao massacre. Ed Lingao is multimedia director for the Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism. The center has produced a series of full-length and short documentaries for TV on the massacre, as well as on other cases of media murders in the Philippines. Luis Teodoro is the deputy director of the Center for Media Freedom and Responsibility. Luis edits the center's media monitoring magazine, writes a column for a major business daily, and is a journalism professor at the University of the Philippines. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. Now, but before we get into the specifics of this case, Ed, tell us why the credible conclusion of this trial is crucial.
Well, it's important because all eyes are on this particular case right now, and whatever happens to this case will send an incredibly huge signal to all parties concerned, to all the stakeholders, whether these are people who are victims or people who are suspects in other cases. In other words, the implications of how this ends will reverberate for a long, long time. It's a test of the justice system. It's a test of the prosecution service. It's a test of the media. It's a test of the national government.
And Luis, what's your opinion on the broader importance of this case?
Well, the massacre occurred in the context of other killings of journalists, which has been happening since 1986. And most of the killings have not been punished. Most of the killers have not been punished, mm-hmm. or the masterminds, for that matter. So this is a turning point, mm-hmm. in that entire issue. If this trial is not credibly concluded, then it will send the message to other people who resent, for example, the way they've been covered by journalists, that it's okay to kill journalists. In other words, it will perpetuate, mm-hmm. The culture of impunity as far as the killing of journalists in the Philippines is concerned. So that's the most immediate meaning of that. But it also has implications on the justice system, as Ed said. I mean, is the justice system working or not? I mm-hmm. mean, also it has implications on the political system as well, because the killings involved supposedly the suspects, the people who are on trial, are come mm-hmm. from a powerful clan in the south, and they managed to influence the outcome of elections and so on and so forth. And the south is also a place where there's a lot of violence, right. So it also puts what's also at stake is the integrity of the political system. It's the integrity of the justice system, the integrity of the political system, right. as well as the impact on the continuing killing of journalists. This trial must be credibly concluded in order to send a message that you can't go on killing journalists and other people, for that matter.
No? Yes.
Since 58 people were killed, not all of them were journalists, 32 were journalists, but the rest were lawyers, okay. supporters of a politician and so on.
Right. And Ed, if you can describe briefly what happened on this day 3 years and 8 months ago in the Southern
it
province.
It was November 23, 2009, just a few months before the 2010 elections. And the Ampatuans, at least the patriarch, had been in office as governor for 9 years by that time. And his son was a regional governor as well. Mm-hmm. And then they had a lot of relatives already in place as mayors or vice mayors throughout the province. Now, then came this challenger who used to be one of their allies, Toto Mangundadatu, who wanted to run against the Ampatuans for mm-hmm. the governorship of Maguindanao. And in trying to file his certificate of candidacy before the Commission on Elections in the province, he sent instead his wife and his sister and some relatives to file it for him, because there's this there's a cultural tradition wherein you're not supposed in that area, you're not supposed to touch the women if ever you have any clan war. So it was thought to be a safe strategy to just have the women file in his stead, his certificate of candidacy. But it turns out they were waylaid. It was a convoy of several vehicles. They were waylaid and they were brought from the highway. They were brought to a remote location 2 kilometers from the main highway. They were all shot and killed. And then there were huge pits dug out of the ground by the provincial backhoe. It's owned by the provincial government. Then some of the vehicles were pushed into the pit. And then these were crushed by the backhoe. And then they piled some of the bodies on top, then piled on some more vehicles, and they tried to cover it with dirt. And that was what happened. It would not have been discovered if not for a search party that was flying over the area, which made the people who were trying to do the cover-up panic, and they left some of the bodies on the ground. In which case, the helicopter spotted the activity, and then some army units came in. But by then, of course, it was too late. You had 58 people dead.
Right.
Basically, in short, that's it.
And Luis, tell us about what happened then as far as the investigation and the hearings that began in that January.
Well, of course, there was an investigation. And then among other things, then-President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo put the area under martial law for a time. And then there were various raids on, the residences of the suspects and so on and so forth. They uncovered a lot of money as well as arms and vehicles and so on. Then finally, the Department of Justice filed the case I think the trial started in 2010. The trial started January 5, 2010, and before the Quezon City Regional Trial Court, Branch 221 of a woman judge, that's Judge Jocelyn Solis Reyes. It started, the trial started January 5, 2010. Against the cases, there were 58 counts of murder filed against 196 supposed perpetrators of the massacre.
And most...
I'm sorry?
And most of them are Ampatuans or supporters of that plan?
Most of them, they included the police as well as armed forces personnel, the 197. There were a number of Ampatuans as well, but there were also, there were 17 Ampatuans, but there were 70, there are 70 police and AFP and armed forces of the Philippines personnel, as well as
militia.
Private militia
members.
There were
some militia members as well who were part of those
private,
accused.
Yeah. And two local government officials. That's a total. Well, it's now 197. There used to be 196. The most recent case. The most recent case was filed 2012. The 197th case.
Okay.
Anyway,
let's take a broad look at this. As far I know, the trial was moved from the southern province. And that may help us understand what that province is like. So, Ed, can you tell us why the trial was moved?
Well, in the first place, nobody wanted to touch the case down south, not even in Cotabato, which is the regional hub, which is where the autonomous region government is located. Nobody wanted to touch the case. In fact, nobody even wanted to issue death certificates, certificates of death. I mean, for a while, the prosecutors were wondering, how do we prove the death of these people if there's no document to show it? Because nobody wanted to do that. Nobody wanted to move. So it's a good thing that the Supreme Court decided that, in the interest of justice, you might as well move it as far away as possible from Maguindanao, because that in that area, of course, the Ampatuans still have primacy until now. So that's a very good reflection of how complicated and how complex and how awkward the situation is there. If you can't even have a trial there of something that happened there that's so big, and that tells you a lot.
And Ed, who are the Ampatuans, and how long have they been? How long had they been in power at that point?
Well, it depends on how far back you want to go. On the regional level, the Ampatuans acquired power only in 2001 when the patriarch, Andal Ampatuan Sr., was elected as governor of Maguindanao. But before that, in the late 80s, he was mayor of Sheriff Aguac. That's the municipality that is the capital of the province. But if you go further back, in the early 1900s, the earliest record we have of the Ampatuan clan was... one of the rebel leaders who was fighting against American occupation forces in the Philippines in the Maguindanao area. That's as far back as we can go. So it seems that it really is a prominent clan from way back, but it achieved a different kind of prominence only in the last decade because of support from the national government.
Right, and Luis, the reason why the national government was letting the area basically rule itself, it was in part because of the votes generated there. Is that correct?
Yes. It's a fairly common pattern. I mean, there are pockets of warlord power all over the Philippines, and in many instances, these are tolerated by the national government because they're able to deliver the votes. So Mindanao was a critical area as far as the administration then was concerned. So. The administration pretty much left the Ampatuans alone because they were able to deliver the votes.
And Luis, could you describe the Datu system that governs much of the southern Philippines and how that plays into what some have claimed as a system of corruption and patronage?
Well, in the first place, that's part of the system. Well, among the Ampatuans, there are 17 who have the title of Datu.
So it's not democratic, it's more bloodlines?
It's a more or less feudal thing in which actually they command the votes. They're able to more or less determine how the people under their jurisdiction, in their jurisdiction, are going to vote for both local as well as national elections.
Okay. And Luis, the current president gave a State of the Union address. Did he bring this subject up?
Not the Ampatuan massacre or the extrajudicial killings. He didn't mention them at all. He did promise in 2010 that he would put a stop to the extrajudicial killings. That was a few months after the Ampatuan massacre, which, of course, took place in 2009. So Mr. Aquino took over the presidency in July 2010.
Yes.
He did promise that during the campaign as well, during the presidential campaign of 2010, he did promise to address the issue of the problem of extrajudicial killings. But he hasn't referred to that in the last two in the last 2 years, I think, in his State of the Nation address.
Ed, Were you waiting to hear that in his speech and disappointed that you did not hear it?
I think everybody was waiting for a mention from the president, either of the Ampatuan massacre case or of extrajudicial killings. And let me also add the Freedom of Information Act. Unfortunately, it was not; these were not mentioned. And I've heard some people argue that the president would not be able to mention everything in his speech in the first place. But if you take it from the point of view of the relatives of the victims as well as from media groups, in terms of messaging, it's important from their viewpoint for these things to be repeated on and on so that it's clear that government policy is set from the top and that these are given priority. Because if in the Philippines, you know, we look for signs, we look for messages, mm-hmm. we look for indications of clarity of where government is going and what direction the president wants to go, and that for a lot of Filipinos is very important. In fact, today is the 44th month anniversary of the Ampatuan massacre, mm-hmm. and we talked to some of the relatives of the victims of the massacre just an hour ago, or 2 hours ago, and they were saying that, yeah, we were waiting. We know that it's not so important for other people, but it's important for the media community, for victims of extrajudicial killings, and for us, because to us, we are still in danger, they said. We are still waiting, and it's important that a message is put across. And that message was not.
And when they say that they feel like they're still in danger, you mean retribution or?
Retribution is one thing. Well, of course, it comes in several levels. One is the possibility of retribution. The other one is it's like a carrot and stick. On one hand, they're afraid that they would be taken out. On the other hand, they've also been wooed so that they could they would opt for a settlement of sorts with the Ampatuans. We've heard amounts bandied around of 25 million pesos. That's around, 500,000 dollars. I'm not sure. I'm not so sure. But okay. 25 million pesos. And that's a huge amount for people who have no livelihood at this point, who've lost their breadwinners in the massacre.
Tell me about that. Who are some of the victims' families and how are they getting along?
Well, it's really a difficult situation for most of them. For example, one grandmother that we talked to, she lost her daughter in the massacre, and her daughter had five kids, mm-hmm. And she was a single mother. So the grandmother now has to take care of five grandchildren all by herself, and she has no job. Of course, some people would say that, you know, it's been 3 years or going on four and it's time to move on. But it's very difficult for these people who've undergone a very traumatic situation to move on, especially in the countryside where there are not as many livelihood opportunities. And, you know, a lot of these widows don't really have jobs, never had jobs because they had breadwinners. So it's a lot of adjustment plus the trauma of what happened and the constant fear. It's that part of the country where it's like the wild, wild west until now. The Ampatuan bailiwick is just an hour's drive away. There's nothing to stop them from coming over. They lock their doors at night. They always have an ear cocked to sounds coming from outside the house at night. Things like that. They cannot sleep. It still bothers them until now.
Are the Ampatuans, do they still hold power?
After the May elections? Let me put it this way. The massacre happened in 2009. Now, in the 2010 elections, we counted at least 42 Ampatuans who were elected to various positions in the local government, from provincial board member to mayor to vice mayor to town councillors. That's a huge amount. That's a huge number of Ampatuans. Now, for the 2013 elections that just passed, we haven't done a count yet of those who won. But we do know that at least 80 members of the Ampatuan clan ran for various positions in the 2013 elections, ranging from provincial board member again up to mayor, vice mayor, and mm-hmm. town councillor. We're not sure exactly of the numbers now after the elections, but we do know that the wives of the primary suspects in the Ampatuan massacre won as mayors of, for example, Datu Hofer Town, Sheriff Aguac Town, and Datu Unsay Town. These are the major towns in Maguindanao, where the capital is in Maguindanao.
Well, I want to get to Luis's your comment on the lingering power of the Ampatuans. But before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to our program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. On the site now is an in-depth story on the fight over this disputed Malaysian state of Sabah that involved invaders from the Philippines' unstable southern region and the Malaysian military. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbi.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. Luis, kind of what's your general feeling about how they can stay in the Apatuans can stay in power after being connected to this massacre, and why your gut feeling about why this still hasn't been brought to justice?
Well, there are a number of reasons why they're able to stay in power. I mean, one of the reasons is that they're a prominent clan. They're very well known. Another reason is because many of the voters are not aware of, they're not even aware of the Ampatuan massacre. And because you have to understand that that in these places, information is difficult to come by, or information is manipulated in a way that favors whatever ruling family is around. So those are among the possible reasons. Of course, there's also the intimidation factor, and there's also the fact that that there's a feudal system in which the prominent clans more or less decide how people should vote.
Now, let's discuss the second part of Ed, that the other topic that you were disappointed you didn't hear in the President's State of the Union speech, and that is the Freedom of Information Act. Tell us what you were hoping to hear about that.
Well, we've been hoping for the President to push the Freedom of Information Bill through Congress for the last, four State of the Nation addresses since he took power in 2010. Mm-hmm. The reason for that being that, of course, to begin with, we of course want a Freedom of Information Act. While the Constitution guarantees that we should have clear and free access to documents, there is no enabling law that would, put in a mechanism for us to be able to access data, information, like you guys do in the United States.
Yeah.
Now, we've been fighting for a law like this for the last, 14 years or for the last four Congresses. Now, when the President was still campaigning for the presidency in 2009, he clearly stated that he was supportive of the FOI, the Freedom of Information Bill, and he said that he will endorse it and push it through Congress if ever he takes power. So we've been holding him to that promise. Unfortunately, he doesn't seem as eager to pursue that promise as he was in 2009 when he was still running. The word we've been hearing from Malacanang is that we'll try to have it done before he steps down. Our concern is that by the time he's about to step down, he may be already a lame duck.
Yes.
And Congress is not very friendly to measures like an FOI, because to begin with, most of the concerns that we've been hearing about the FOI come from the congressmen. These are people who would rather keep information secret because it involves contracts, it involves deals, it involves a lot of money. And so our biggest stumbling block has been Congress, and Congress has repeatedly told us in the last 3 years that the president's not pushing it, so why should we prioritize it? So the buck gets tossed upstairs.
Luis?
Well, that's true. It's true that it's the Congress that's the problem. But Mr. Aquino is also a problem, because he could very well send a message to his allies in Congress that that an FOI bill would be his priority, would be among his legislative priorities. But he hasn't done that. Mr. Aquino himself is also the problem, because Mr. Aquino apparently, although he did say in 2010 that 2009 I think no 2010 that he was going to support a Freedom of Information Act, he eventually changed his mind, and there are indications, there have been several indications as to why he changed his mind. For example, last year in four occasions in which four media events last year, he criticized the media for inaccuracy, focusing on trivia, focusing on his love life, being biased and reporting the bad news and all of that. And in other occasions, he has also said in more or less in these words that the media are too powerful. Apparently, he's focused on the media. He doesn't realize, or his administration is not too interested in recognizing the fact that an FOI bill would be for every citizen, not just for the media. So they're focused on the implications of an FOI bill for the media. They think that the media would be too powerful. Now, as far as the congressmen are concerned, Ed is right. I mean, they're more concerned with keeping things secret. Apparently, they don't want the public to know what's going on in the case, or because there are certain things that they would rather keep secret rather than make public.
Okay, Edna.
It's even interesting to point out that one congressman even proposed an amendment to the FOI that let's make it non-retroactive. That means that if we do pass an FOI, says this congressman, sure, let's pass it, but let's say that it does not apply to previous information before the bill was passed, which means that whatever we've done in the past, it will not be dug up anymore. You get those kinds of arguments.
Right.
Another amendment was another proposed amendment was to include a rider in an FOI act, which would compel the media to publish or to air replies. As a matter of law, they would be compelled to publish or air replies rather than leaving that to the discretion of the media organization.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Ed Lingao of the Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism and Luis Teodoro of the Center for Media, Freedom, and Responsibility. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Elisa Lopez was our lead producer. Free Press Watch is up next, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now Free Press Watch, a weekly segment on Global Journalist, where we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Elisa Lopez. Today's news comes from the New York Times, Reporters Without Borders, and the Washington Post. Mexican police discovered the bodies of Alberto López Bello, a crime reporter for regional newspaper El Imparcial, and Alejandro Franco, an intelligence officer for the Federal Police, last week in the city of Oaxaca. Both corpses showed signs of torture, lesions, bruises, and bullet wounds. It is uncertain if the crime is linked to López Bello's work as a journalist. The Mexican government has recently implemented two legal measures to protect journalists in the country, where, according to Freedom House, 82 have been murdered since 2000. In Cameroon, gay activist Eric Cohen Alembembe was found tortured and murdered July 15. The Cameroonian government has criticized the national media for their coverage on the issue, saying journalists have engaged in speculation and witch hunting. Government spokesman Issa Chiroma also said that coverage damages Cameroon's image in the international panorama. Homosexual sex is illegal in Cameroon, and Human Rights Watch says the country pursues more anti-gay prosecutions than any other country in Africa. In Colombia, the Supreme Court has acquitted journalist Luis Agustín González of criminal defamation and libel charges July 10, 2 years after he was first sentenced. In 2011, the editor of the regional newspaper Cundinamarca Democrática was sentenced to a 20-month prison term for libel and criminal insult of a politician in an opinion column. The prison term was then reduced to 18 months and 18 days in 2012. González said he is happy with the ruling and that it could strengthen freedom of the press and expression in Colombia, although there is a lot of self-censorship. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Elisa Lopez.